I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey listeners, thank you so much for listening to the Liverbird Sailing podcast, and a special thank you to my Patreons who are supporting the show on a monthly basis. If you find value in the show, please consider joining this lovely group of people. Just check out the link in the description or go to patreon.com/Liverbird Sailing Podcast to see some extra content and behind the scenes updates. This week there will be some extra content from this very episode. Now, on with the show. Here's what's coming up next.
And we were cruising. We hit one at like 2 knots, and then we hit one at like 5 knots. So at least we know our boat's pretty strong because we didn't get any damage. I've dove the boat since. So that was a low point. You know, hitting icebergs was not great. But again, it's inspiring to know that our boat's pretty stout. We can hit those things and not sink.
Welcome to the podcast. I am your host, Annika. On the Liverbird Sailing podcast, I chat with awesome people who live, work, and travel on their sailboats. My guests share inspiring stories and real-life advice about the lifestyle so that you and I can be better prepared for our sailing adventures. Today we are talking all about Alaska with Mark and Sharon from Sailing Naiad. They are Pacific Northwest sailors who did an epic trip to British Columbia through the Inside Passage to Alaska. There is talk about glaciers and hot springs and how to plan and prepare your boat for a trip like this, but really this is a story of a family who loves to travel. And indeed, today we are talking to a young family, so a heads up that even though it's the adults that do the talking, you'll hear some, shall we say, contributions from the young ones in the background. And a fun little tidbit, Mark and Sharon were actually sailing while we did this interview, so Starlink really does work as well as they say. Now, here we go with Mark and Sharon. Maybe we'll start with a little bit of an introduction. So I know you have a couple of kids there, you have a bit of an animal kingdom there with cats and dogs and all that. So who do we have on board your boat?
Well, we've got two kids. So I guess I'll start by saying we have way more living things on the boat that we ever intended to. We kind of had fertility issues in the past. And so we got two big dogs that were kind of our children. And lo and behold, we lucked out and were able to get pregnant somewhat recently. And so now we're living with two dogs. We've got a 150-pound Newfoundland who's just, he's probably the better boat dog because he doesn't do a whole lot on the boat.
He
just sleeps.
He doesn't need a lot of exercise.
Yeah. And then we've got a Australian Shepherd mix. And that one, he's got a lot of energy. but they do pretty well on the boat. And then, you know, we had in the past, we had 10 acres down in Oregon, so we got barn cats, and they slowly became house cats, and we now have...
A boat cat.
A boat cat. she's just a gray long hair, and our kids are, oh man, pretty...
Kennedy's three, she's almost three, and Blakely will be turning one at the very end of our trip.
Yeah.
So it's when parental leave ends.
Yeah, everyone we met on the trip was like, wow, how the hell are you doing this with all those dogs and kids? But it's pretty easy when you have enough space.
Yeah,
well, speaking of space, what kind of a boat do you have then?
So our latest boat is it's about a 50-year-old boat, 1973 Maple Leaf. Not a lot of people know about them. They were built up in Vancouver by Cooper Yachts. And I think they made them from like early 1970s till late 1980s. Mm-hmm. Pretty long run of them. But they're really nice for the Northwest because they have a huge enclosed cockpit. It's not a pilot station, but it's got enough staterooms and a couple bathrooms that we have enough space. And it's a center cockpit, so my wife and I can stay in the aft area. Our oldest toddler is up in the front, being independent. And so it gives us a bit of breathing room.
Yeah. And the cockpit's a great place for the kids to play. Like we said, it's enclosed and it's got like high walls and gates, so they can just roam around in here while we're under sail and they're safe. We know they're safe. We don't have to worry. They can have all their toys up here and it's a great place for them to grow up.
Yeah, yeah. It's a bit of, I would definitely encourage anyone with kids looking at shopping. I mean, a little bit of a tangent, but definitely looking at center cockpits because it's just, you can kind of do your sailing thing and let them roam around like in a giant playpen, which is the center cockpit, and not have to worry about them so much. When the weather gets a little bit worse, they generally go down below. But yeah, it's been a really great boat for us.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a lot to keep an eye out as well, because you have the dogs at the cat and two kids that you're going to have to be aware of where everybody is at a certain time. So I'm sure that makes for some interesting sailing.
Yeah, to say the least. It can be a little stressful, but when it really hits the fan,
yeah.
I won't curse. I'll try not to. I bet him have a potty mouth. But it turns into Sharon generally watches the kids just because if we're heeling really hard and it's getting rough, we don't want them falling across the cabin. It's got a pretty big beam, and that's one of the downsides to it. So we have someone watching the kids, making sure they're okay. And then it turns into me kind of single-handing. And it's a lot of boat to single hand. But luckily, the previous owner put a lot of nice features on here, like electric winches, a lot of self-tailing winches for controlling the reefing. So it's really easy to control it, even though it's 48 feet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, how did you get into this? You mentioned you had a farm. And now, obviously, you have a slightly less room. Still a big boat, but a little bit less room. So how did you get into the sailing lifestyle?
Oh, man. Yeah, kind of to take it full circle, not to give you too much of an explanation. But I grew up boating. We came from the dark side, power boating. My family every year would come up to Desolation Sound for about a month or two. And we'd kind of just gunk hole around, and so I grew up around boats. I learned pretty much everything about boating other than sailing, right? So a lot applies, nautical navigation, anchoring, docking, just general boat safety. So I kind of had that coming into sailing, and then I just out of necessity started teaching myself to sail in high school because I didn't have any money, and me and my buddies wanted to go up to the San Juans and kind of spend some time on our summer break. But we just didn't have money for, you know, driving a big powerboat around or any of that. So I taught myself to sail. And first boat was a WD Shock 21, Santana 21. They're really great, like miniature full fin keel sailboats that kind of miniaturize as a big cruising boat. So it's really great to learn on. And then Sharon, if you want to, your background.
I actually grew up nowhere near the water. I grew up in Southern Oregon, where farming and ranching were... My every summer I was out bucking hay. Then I went up to college, and that's where Mark and I met, and he was into water. So I, of course, like a typical girlfriend, was like, cool, let's do this, and jumped aboard and learned how to sail with him. And
that's been a while. Yeah. So we graduated, we met in college and business class, and I think 2008, 2009, started dating. And then when we graduated in 2010, we decided to buy our first big boat, which was a great introductory big boat because it was cheap and not very intimidating, which was a 36-foot Hunter Legend, 1988. Really, I really love that boat, even though people trash Hunters. They kind of have a bad reputation, but
it was great.
You know, if you don't plan on sailing around the world and you just intend to use it in the Northwest, it was perfect. Really great boat to learn on. We had that for a couple years, ended up selling it after we put some work into it.
And we were moving to California.
Yeah. So we've had like this cyclical relationship with sailing. We do it for a couple of years and then something calls us away and then we come back to it. And that's happened like three times. Yeah. So that time I got a job to work with Apple down in Cupertino. I'm an architect by trade. So I was doing kind of high-end residential work or retail work for them. And we lived in Cupertino for a couple of years. Didn't make sense to have the boat up in the Northwest. So we sold it. And then we just were
missing it.
So we, after a couple of years down there, we're like, we need to get back to the Northwest. You need to get a boat again. This is not right. So we ended up buying a Jeannot Sunshine 36 down there. And we got a really good deal on it. And we were able to truck that from California up to Pacific Northwest. We worked on that for, it was in really rough shape. So we spent about 3 months fixing it up when we expected to only work on it for, I don't know, maybe a month.
Yeah,
it just
definitely
turned,
took a little bit longer than that.
It turned into
a... It was a typical boat project.
Typical boat projects. You know, it's like times it by 300 and or three, yeah. You know, 300% of what you expect. So we kind of, we were young at the time, didn't have a lot of money. We ran out of money. So we got the boat fixed and we were living aboard. That was
sneaking
in
aboard.
2012 or so. And
yeah,
kind of before we even really knew anything about live aboards or that you could even do it. We were just kind of doing
it. We did it out of necessity.
Yeah. We just didn't have a home. We were out of money. And that boat was perfect for us. We fixed it up with the intent of doing the Inside Passage. And we lived aboard while working various jobs trying to earn money. And then I took off in 2014 to do the Inside Passage on that boat. And Sharon at the time had a really good job she really liked. And so she didn't want to quit it. I quit my job. Well, semi-quit. They agreed to let me take 3 months off. And then it turns out I ended up quitting before I went back, which I feel bad about because it was a really great job. But yeah, that was the first trip. So I did it solo in 2014, up and back, and then loved it so much. That was the whole reason I decided to even marry Sharon. We weren't married at the time. And it's just such a profound, well, when you do it solo too, it's like very self-reflective and you feel very small in the shadow of these huge granite peaks that you're sailing under. And it just kind of made me realize I got to marry that girl. I had been dilly-dallying for a while. I think we had been dating for like 8 years or something. Yeah. And it was time. So I proposed when I got back and we got married on that boat, eloped and had it for a few years and did the farm thing after that boat in we moved down to Southern Oregon, like 2014.
Yeah. Something like that.
We kept it for a little while, but it didn't make sense. Again, we were away from the boat. It was in the Northwest. And so we sold it. And all the boats we've sold, we've kind of made up our costs. So a little bit of profit on them. So it's kind of helped out. We've been saving a little bit between boats. And then we were in Southern Oregon for 2 years. Really loved it. Did the homestead kind of lifestyle. We had pygmy goats, like 30 chickens. seven acres. We always say 10 just to round up, but it's actually seven. Really loved it, but the forest fires down there kind of drew us away.
It was always hard to live in the evacuation zone every summer. So
yeah, we were. Every summer we were in the evacuation zone and just didn't enjoy summers. So we,
the water was calling again.
Water was calling again. Yeah. So we moved back to Washington, bought a Dufour 31, like immediately.
Yeah. Like day three back up here, we bought a boat.
Yeah. Which was a great boat, for us at the time. We didn't know we could get pregnant. We had been trying for years. So we just had two dogs and, it's like, oh, this would be a perfect, you know, small pocket cruiser for cruising around. And then literally like, I don't know, 2-3 months later, you found out you're pregnant, which is amazing. We'd been trying for so long, but it quickly made that boat very small. It's like, oh gosh.
Shopping began.
Yeah. Well, we had it for a little while. We did some winter cruising on it. And we outfit that boat for going to Alaska. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of get into this. This is kind of long, long-winded explanation, but there's kind of a lot to it. But the way we were able to do the trip to Alaska was parental leave. So Washington State allows you up to 6 months unpaid from your employer. It's kind of a guaranteed right for the father or the mother. And up to three of that, you can have subsidized from the state. And that came into effect, I think, sometime 2019,
right, a
year before we had a kid. So with Kennedy, we decided we wanted to take 3 months off. We got subsidized pay through the state, and we were going to shoot off for Alaska. So we outfit the Dufour just top to bottom, ready for the trip. We got radar on it, AIS, redundant systems for depth sounders. I think we had like a new sail for it. Davits, like the whole bit. It was ready. New electronics, the whole thing. We kind of really outfit it to make it comfortable. And then COVID hit. So in 2020, the border closed down. We couldn't go up to Alaska. People were saying you could possibly just straight shot it if you didn't stop or anything. And it just didn't seem like British Columbia is a big part of it. And we didn't want to miss out on that. So we decided we'd just gunk hole around for 3 months on that boat. But then we were like, well, you know, we got 3 months off. That'd be a good time to maybe upgrade the boat because, you know, it's getting small and we wanted to have two kids eventually. So we just started looking around as you do. And we found this boat. We're actually looking at a few, and we kept looking at the Endeavor 51 down in Everett for a while. Like we went aboard this one boat that was for sale, a little bit out of our budget, but we viewed it maybe three or four times, and we're just like, it just didn't quite feel right. You know, when you get aboard the boat that you want, it's like it clicks.
You know,
it's like,
instantly that it's your
boat. I want this boat. Yeah, I need this boat. But there's some compromises, and there's things to it always. Sorry,
but yeah.
But yeah, you just get that feeling like this feels right. And when we got aboard Naiad, we always do videos of when we're touring boats, just because when you're looking at the boat, you're so excited, you like just don't see a lot of the details in what you're looking at. One thing we always advise people to do is take a GoPro, take your phone, whatever, and slowly, like just pan around slowly so you can go back home after you see the boat. And really dive into some of the things you would definitely miss if you were just walking on it excited the first time. I remember on that video, I was just like, we were both like, oh man, let's buy this boat. We were talking like what we're going to offer them and all this. And it worked out. We got, we really lucked out with this boat. I think we had a budget of like $100,000 we had saved up. And the boat was old, so you couldn't really get a loan on it. Made it hard to sell for the owner, I think. He was asking $100,000 for it, and or just under that, like 90 something.
Yeah.
And we went back and forth. We offered him like 60, and I think we went under contract for like 65. Mm-hmm. And it was a bit of a stretch for us because we know old boats, you got to put a lot of money into them. And we were trying to save a big enough cushion that we wouldn't go broke fixing it up like we had in the past. We felt comfortable, but it was a bit of a stretch, and we both agreed, you know, if anything comes up on the survey, we're just gonna walk away. And the owner, we ended up finding like one little issue with this boat, which we both agreed it has a cored hull, so below the waterline, but it's fortunately not balsa. It was the first time they used closed cell foam, so it should hold up. But we had heard like horror stories of it getting wet and people having to delaminate the sides of the boat to dry it out, and just super expensive procedure. And so we agreed, if there's any moisture from the survey, we're just going to walk away. We had a really good surveyor, and he was sounding the hull, and he found in the quarter section, he found an area of either delamination or moisture. And we stuck to our guns. We said, we're going to walk away. This is not, you know, it's too much of an unknown. We're at the limit. We can't afford it. We didn't want to, you know, try and offer him even less. He had owned the boat for 25 years, and you could tell he really loved it. And we just said, we really love it. Just not going to work out. And it was really hard walking away. We were really passionate about it. But I think out of charity, that's the only thing I can think, is he called us up like that night and said, you know, I really think you guys are the perfect fit for this boat. What do you say if I just give it to you for $25,000? And we were just like, oh, deal. Yeah. we'll do that. So we really lucked out with it. And, you know, at the time we were like, oh, what the hell's wrong with this boat? You know, why is he selling it to us for $25,000? There must be something wrong, but we'll roll the dice anyway. And we've owned it for 2 years now, and I've run through every system. I think I've done everything on it. I've done core samples, and it wasn't even wet. It was just like a delamination from probably manufacturing. So we really lucked out. He's put a lot of effort into this boat. So we haven't really had to do a lot to get an outfit for Alaska. Yeah. But yeah, this probably will be our forever home for at least the next 10 years. Yeah, we're planning on taking it down to Mexico and then possibly Marquesas. We bought the charts to like plan our route. Yeah. Yeah. After Alaska, I will sell Alaska, but after a summer up there, you really start dreaming about like tropical beaches and warm weather. So yeah, that's kind of on our mind right now. But anyway, really long story for our history. That's kind of our background.
Wow. What a cool, evolution of your boat journey, going from one boat to another. And B, that is an amazing deal. I was already impressed that you were offering 65 on a boat that was asking 90 something and you got it for 25. That is mind blowing.
We're pretty good at finding the amazing right boats to get some really good deals for.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, we've lucked out. I mean, we want to chat about Alaska. I won't go on too much of a tangent, but I think every boat we've bought, it's been a quarter, like a third to a quarter of the asking price. There's just kind of a strategy to it. We lucked out on this one. We kind of went off the rails.
Yeah, this one's a crazy one.
This was just like charity. The guy just probably was like, oh, these poor kids, let's give them a boat. You know, they got this nice family. I think the trick is you just have to borrow kids when you go boat shopping. Yeah, it's something about it.
That's awesome. Well, all right. So Alaska, definitely. Let's talk about that. You mentioned a few times now that, you know, the boats that you had were outfitted for Alaska. So I'm curious to hear about your planning for that trip. Obviously, it was a long trip of 4 months. So how did you plan for it? And what did you do to your boat to make it sure it was good for it?
Yeah, we kind of learned a bit from my first trip doing it and kind of leveraged that for the next trip. I mean, honestly, you could take a bare boat up there. It's just not going to be as enjoyable. Really, everything you do is just for either safety or comfort. The first boat I did it on, just as a preface, it was a kind of a racer cruiser. Didn't have a heater, didn't have a dodger. I think I had radar. I didn't have AIS and just a depth sounder. And I was able to do it. But, you know, like the whole time I was cold and miserable. It rains so much. You get like one day of sun every week. And so it'd be like a yard sale. I'd get all my clothes drying out and my sleeping bag. So I would say even in the summer, you'd want a heater to dry your boat out if for the comfort factor. I would say like a must-have list is radar, obviously sonar, but yeah. I would encourage redundant sonar in case it goes out. It's relatively cheap to put in a second transducer, and you can get ones that shoot through the hole so you don't have to drill another hole in your boat. And
AIS is another thing.
AIS, I'd highly encourage.
A lot of people don't have it, but we definitely found it very useful.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say,
radar
and then AIS. And then in terms of weather routing, we bought an Iridium Go for the trip. And I'm not a huge fan of the Iridium Go now that we have Starlink. So, you know, we picked up Starlink when we were on the trip, but I would say some way to get weather forecasts, predict wind or windy or anything like that, to be able to compare some models. They do have Alaska HRR, which is, you know, it predicts 48 hours in advance, but we found that to be really accurate for some of the in little channels and things. But VHF, one thing to know is like VHF, some of the fjords you go into, you can't get VHF weather reception. So you need some way, either, a sat phone to call someone to be able to download that for you, or a way to download it. And having that resource, which I didn't have in 2014, I mean, I don't think we ever hit any bad weather. We were able to time it. So like if there was a blow going through, we just sit out and wait it out in an anchorage, you know, a beautiful anchorage, fishing and crabbing and shrimping.
Yeah, didn't have any weather surprises.
Yeah, yeah. So there's, you know, common things that you would have on a cruising boat, but maybe people wouldn't think, you know, a sat phone for Alaska, but I would encourage some way to get weather is a big one.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, those are important things to have and be aware of. Are there any permits or anything like that required for that, or can anyone just go at any time, do whatever?
So Glacier Bay was one of our itinerary goals. And Glacier Bay, it's got a couple things to know about it. There's a permit required if you go there after sometime in June. We were trying to remember the dates, but
they also change.
They have it. But it's good to double check us. We'll say broad dates, but sometime before June, you can just go in without a permit. But it's really hard to get that far north unless you leave really early, like April. So between June and I think like September, you need a permit to go in. And they do two permit operations. They have an advance permit, which you can apply for 60 days in advance of when you intend to enter the park. But it's really hard to do. You have to, they open up at 7 a.m. and you have to submit it like at 7 a.m. via email, have it all, the application filled out, ready to go and shoot it off.
And you also have to know when you intend to be there. And that's,
yeah,
I think,
that's the tricky
part.
Bit. Yeah. So 60 days out. We applied for it and we got denied. I think we shot it off at like 7:05 and it was just for a busy time, sometime in July. So we won it and we were going for the short term permit. So they also have, they hold a select few for just a couple days advance. So you can get up to Juneau or Hoonah, you know, somewhere close by where you can get into the park in a couple days. And then you can apply for a permit for 2 days in advance of your entry. And that's what we ended up getting. And we heard horror stories of people waiting weeks to get that. We lucked out and we got it our first day. We totally fumbled the ball and we submitted our application at 7 a.m. the 2 days before, and I emailed it, but our email apparently wasn't working. And I called to verify that they had gotten it. And they said, nope, we didn't get it, but we'll take it over the phone now. And it was like 7:30. I was like, well, there's no way we're going to get it now. But apparently we hit it during a lull and we were able to get it anyway. So it kind of depends, but you can go for those two. The short term is just easier because it's hard to forecast how quick your pace is going to be getting up that far. But that's the permit process, getting in there. And then anyone with dogs, like in our situation, or pets, you can't take them to shore. So one thing that is crucial is to get your dogs to go on the bow or, you know, on your stern, turf trained on your boat, because you can't take them to shore. And I would definitely encourage anyone with dogs to do that anyway, even if you're not going to Glacier Bay, because there's so many times we've been anchored out and there's like, oh, there's just three grizzly bears on shore. And our dogs, my dog looks like a grizzly bear. So, you know, he would just be like, oh, hey, buddy, you know, and just walk up to him, I'm sure. So there were a lot of times we just didn't even take the dogs to shore, or the topography is just so steep too. You can't even, it would just be a real challenge to get your dogs on shore with a skiff. So if you have animals, definitely try and get them bow trained.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The interesting about that Glacier Bay with the restrictions on dogs and also the permit, and I guess it's just because it's a national park area.
Yeah.
So it's, they just don't want dogs, you know, defacing. It's just similar to like some parks and stuff. They just don't let dogs. It's probably for the better. There's lots of wildlife on shore that you probably don't want your dogs on shore anyway. So,
yeah, fair enough. And obviously, I've seen your photos from that area and from the trip in general, and they look fantastic. One thing I don't see in the photos is the mosquitoes and bugs and whatever flying creatures there are.
Oh, so they're how there. Bad are they? Just can't see
them. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, do we want people to go to Alaska or not?
We want to tell them what to expect.
Yeah. It wasn't as bad this year, but like when I did in 2014, I was just constantly attacked because we didn't have a dodge or any way to escape them. So honestly, the worst bit, which I didn't get in 2014 at all, was horseflies.
Yeah, those are terrible.
So yeah, we would get, we lucked out with Glacier Bay where we got just a week of nothing but sun. It was amazing, except for the fact that when the sun comes out, the horseflies come out in droves. It was insane. We had some buddy boats that also didn't have an enclosure, and they left the park early because they just couldn't handle it. They were getting attacked, and there's no way to escape them. So I would say there's that. Bring a lot of fly swatters and
have fun with it.
If you have some way to button up your boat, you know, like I'd really encourage people to do a companionway screen or get screens for all your vents, because when it gets hot, it gets hot. And you need to be able to open it up without getting swarmed by bugs. And then there's also, there's mosquitoes, but honestly, they're not any bigger than the state, like the Continental 48.
Yeah.
There's always these horror stories of like, oh, mosquitoes so big, you'd ride them or whatever. But you really don't. I mean, we don't get that in Southeast Alaska, maybe further North Alaska, but not really down here.
Yeah.
But the one thing you do get are
no-see-ums.
So that's the no-see-ums are pretty brutal, and they can get through some smaller screens. So be fair warned. Those are the bugs.
Okay. The warning is out there now. That's fair enough. So obviously the trip from the Pacific Northwest up to Alaska includes the whole Inside Passage, unless you're really going around Vancouver Island. So maybe can you explain and describe a little bit what is the Inside Passage? Because a lot of people probably have heard of it, but may not actually know what we're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll do my best to give in like a good clear definition of it, but essentially it's the safe water route from the Pacific Northwest all the way up to Southeast Alaska. And it goes through the west side of British Columbia. So there's only two areas that you really have to be exposed to ocean swell, depending on where you go. But if you really want to play it safe, there's rounding Cape Caution, just north of Vancouver Island. It's about a day crossing around the Cape, and it can get really rough. I mean, people have lost their lives doing that from unexpected gales and things. So it's not to be taken lightly, but if you just plan it with a weather window, it's a piece of cake. And East Dixon Entrance, which is north of Prince Rupert, between Prince Rupert and going to Ketchikan. And that is also notoriously, it can get bad. And the reason for it is it's both of those are shoaling seas. So it's not, it goes from, you know, thousands and thousands of feet to about 100 feet. The waves can just build and build and get really steep and break. So it's just dangerous from that standpoint if you're not being respectful of the sea conditions or the wind. But again, you just wait it out as long as you have time. I mean, that's the big thing. Just give yourself time and then those aren't, you know, any huge issue. But there are also routes. So that's the Inside Passage route and it's protected. But there are also routes you can take that are semi-protected that are considered like the inside outside.
Yeah.
And you just get little sections of exposed to the ocean. But you get away from, you know, boating crowds and stuff. There's just like a lifetime of cruising up there. But that's generally the area if you're looking at a general map.
Right, exactly. So it's it sounds like it might be a little bit of a challenge, but is it difficult to navigate? Like, are there a lot of, I don't know, a lot of little islands or currents or things like that to take into consideration in the planning?
Yeah, well, I mean, I would say depends where you're coming from. So, you know, if you've got experience boating in the Northwest, piece of cake. I mean, if you're used to timing passages like narrows, if you know to look at a current chart to make sure you're crossing at slack or not at a point where it's going to be dangerous, that's really all you have to do. I mean, there's a lot of areas where you do have kind of wicked currents that you need to time the rapids. There's some sections like Wrangell Narrows where the current can run up to like five or six knots. So, and it's not dangerous, but if you're going against that current, you're obviously motoring at six knots. You can't make any progress in a sailboat. So you just have to time it. And all the guidebooks tell you how to do it. So like Wrangell Narrows, it on a flood, it comes in from the south and then it ebbs out to the north, like at a midway point. So you try and time it coming in to hit that midway point right at slack. So you're catching the flood in and then you catch the ebb out and you get like a crazy boost of speed. So like you generally have to motor it because it's a really narrow navigational passage. But like we motor at six knots. And I think that whole trip we were doing like eight, nine knots because we had a boost of current with us the whole way. So you just want to, you want to time those things, but there's a great resource of other boaters. I mean, if you're unfamiliar with it, you can ask people at the dock like 3 days ahead of time because everyone's going the same way, you know, and hey, when are you leaving or what's your plan for this? So
yeah. And it's a great community. Everybody's out there to help one another.
So. Yeah, you just take it day by day. I mean, you have a general idea of where you're going to be going and then you kind of just plan 3 days out and look at the currents 3 days out and the weather 3 days out. And it changes. So I would say navigationally, just, you know, learning those things, if you're new to boating and you don't have a lot of experience under your belt, you know, just trying to do some of the rapids that are closer by, like Dodd Narrows or something, and just get comfortable with it, maybe. But it's really not difficult if you have any sort of boating experience in the Northwest. Like we've met so many people who have been boating for years in this area and they haven't gone north of like the Brottons because the crossing Cape Caution is kind of a concerning thing. You have to go out in the ocean and, you know, people just get kind of worried about it. But it just gets better and better. The more you like, if you just take that leap to go across Cape Caution, you get fewer boaters. The scenery is beautiful. You get anchorages to yourself. I mean, it just it's totally worth it. And it's one boater we met. He always refers to something as a easy burger or something. Yeah. Yes, I've been saying that a lot. It's an easy burger. Yeah, it's not anything if you just time it right.
Yeah, exactly. So with proper planning and preparation, it's not impossible. Just know what you're doing kind of thing.
Yeah. And even if you don't know what you're doing, it's
it's easy. I mean, there's so much information out there that you can definitely learn before going. If you just give yourself the time.
I don't want to get people in trouble. but yeah, I mean, you know, if you're intimidated by it, the idea of doing the Inside Passage, I would encourage people not to be. It's not anything crazy. There's not any really big challenges. It just as long as you know the basics of navigation. The only thing I would recommend to people is just to be aware of is when you get further north, the charts are just completely inaccurate. So if you're used to, you know, cruising in the Northwest and you're like, you know, you hear people about hitting rocks in the Pacific Northwest, like in Seattle area, it's like, there's no way you hit a rock unless you just weren't looking at the chart. But when you get up to Alaska, like they'll have rocks indicated, but you read the guidebook and it's like, oh, by the way, the rock on the chart's like a few hundred yards off. Or, hey, by the way, there's like three rocks that aren't on the chart. Or, by the way, you know, the shoal extends out a few hundred yards well beyond what the charts show. I mean, it's just they were all surveyed, I think, like in the 50s. So things change. And we even were guilty of it. We ended up grounding for the first time ever up on the east side of or the west side of Chichagof, I think, right?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, Didrikson Bay. Yeah, which is notoriously poorly charted. There's tons of rocks. It's, you know, rough coastline. It's on the ocean side. So we did a little bit of outside cruising. We went from Sitka on the outside of Chichagof up to Pelican and Elfin Cove. So we were kind of exposed to the ocean for a few days. And there's a lot of little cool anchorages you can go in there. But Didrikson was a tricky one because it was a shoaling head of a bay. And just, you know, uniform half circle kind of shoal on the chart. And typically, you know, if the shoals move, they move uniformly and kind of just they progress, but they kind of keep the same shape as in the chart. Or so I thought. So we did our typical thing, which is to try and find the chart or the shoal. So coming in at like 60 feet, we come in dead slow and try and find where it starts coming up. So we know how far we need to anchor off. And we were coming in on the west side. And it went from 60 feet, started coming up to 50. We started doing our turns and, we see it starting to come up and it went from 50 feet to 4 feet. We grounded instantly. It was the quickest shoal I've ever seen. And it was tricky because we came out on the west side and it was the shoal was in like a unicorn spire coming out in the middle of the bay. So we had favored one side. And as we turned to come around, we just ran dead into the shoal. Nowhere in the guidebooks, nowhere in reviews that anyone said anything about it. So but not a lot of people cruise out there. So, and we, we hit it. I did just looked at the tide and we always try and come in on a shoal, on a rising tide so that if we do hit it, we can float off. And we had just missed the high tide for like the next 24 hours and it was drying. And so we were like, oh shit, you know, oh yeah, no cussing. Oh shoot. How do we get off this shoal? The current pushed us on and we were I was trying to reverse forward off of it. We couldn't get off of it. And I was just thinking, oh man, we're going to be stuck here for, we're going to get, because the tides are so extreme. It would have dropped 15 feet that day. We would have been on the hard, probably damaged our boat. We were just, so in a quick moment of brilliance, which are rare for me, we dropped our dinghy, which has the motor still on it. And we were able to leave it on the davits, and just motor our stern, like kind of like with a bow thruster or stern thruster. Yeah, I threw it in reverse and we spun the stern off to where we could pull off the shoal. But that just goes as to say, like, we've been boating for a lot of years up in here, up in this area, and people are still prone to those kind of mistakes. So just be really cautious when you start to get further north. Alaska, even some parts of British Columbia aren't charted very well when you get further north. So don't go in blind, like, you know, gunning it into these small anchorages, like fully confident the chart's right, because it's not.
Yeah, no, those are super good tips, because obviously the more information or, you know, data you have at your disposal that you can look at off the surrounding environment, that's going to make everything easy. And I was going to ask you about your sort of your, you know, the highlights and the low points of your trip. So does that grounding count as a low point?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know that it's a low point, though, because it's an experience that we learned from, not just in like a way for us to get off of that, but also we learned that we can actually react pretty quickly.
But you know, it's anytime you have a close call and you come away unscathed, it's like, okay, yeah, you know, you feel good about it. Well, in retrospect.
Yes.
But I kind of pride myself on my captaining ability. So a lot of these, like, we saw 10 glacier thereabouts, and a few of them, like Tracy's Arm and some in Glacier Bay, there's lots of huge bergy bits in the water, which anyone who is preparing for the trip, I read guides, they'll explain a lot of that. And I end up smacking two of them. But you know, my ratio is, we saw 10 glaciers hit two icebergs. That's not too bad. But we, they were big too. Like, we hit one that was larger than a big beach ball, but they're crystal clear. They have no air in them. So you can't see them. And when they're that size, they sit right below the surface. So it's kind of like a terrifying deadhead.
Yeah.
And we were cruising, we hit one at like 2 knots and we hit one at like 5 knots. So at least we know our boat's pretty strong, because we didn't get any damage. I've dove the boat since. So that was a low point. You know, hitting icebergs was not great, but again, it's inspiring to know that our boat's pretty stout. We can hit those things and not sink.
Still avoid them.
But, you know, so there's that kind of stuff. The highlights, though, oh man,
there's so many.
Yeah, I don't know. How long do we have? Well, I don't know. What were some of your highlights?
I would say my first highlight of the trip was definitely going down Dean's Channel to Yukaut Hot Springs. There we had, Mark says, thousands of dolphin. I would say multiple hundreds of dolphin.
No, you're dead
swimming
wrong.
With us. Yes, this is a debate regularly. But anyway, we were just surrounded by dolphins as we are sailing down this beautiful channel, and then we sail right into this incredible fjord with a hot spring and a bear on shore. And that was my first highlight of the trip, I would say.
Yeah, just like huge granite cliffs coming right down to the water. You're kind of anchoring in this basin. And it was one of the times where we didn't have really a deep anchorage.
Yeah.
So that was nice. But yeah, Sharon's wrong. There were thousands of dolphins. I took a video of it, and I don't want to rub it into her, but I'm going to like freeze frame it and count all the fins. Because, I mean, I've been boating up here a long time and I've seen dolphins. Like, they'll swim at the end.
There are so many.
I was blown away. They were just like, as far as you could see, just thousands.
Okay.
But anyway,
we'll agree to disagree.
That was pretty cool. Sharon convinced me to go down there. Dean's Channel is like a bit off the beaten path. And I was like, you know, it's a day in there. We're probably gonna have to motor. I don't really want to be motoring down there. Can we just like hit it on the way back maybe? And it turned out to be like her best decision, because we had nothing but great winds, like downwind sailing the way there and then downwind on the way back.
Yeah.
And saw just a ton of the wildlife, and the hot springs were awesome.
Yeah, so they were really great. So that was our first, I would say that was my first highlight of the whole trip.
Yeah.
And Ford's Terra was pretty fun too.
Yeah, I'd say Ford's Terra was probably my highlight. So if for folks that don't know about Ford's Terra, because I didn't really know much about it, just Google it. It's really Man, it is.
The review on Navionics is that it is the Yosemite on water without all of the traffic. And it is not wrong. It is not wrong.
It's definitely, man, it's like anchoring. It is like anchoring in Yosemite.
It's
like you're just surrounded by a cathedral of granite cliffs that come right down to the water.
And it's a more difficult anchorage to get into. So there's hardly ever other boats.
So there's only like high water slack is really the only time you can get in. And there's no current charts for the passage. It's a really narrow, like, I don't know, 40, 50 foot wide passage. And it's when it's raging, it's like a waterfall coming through the rapids. So it drops, I think, like 10 feet from one end to the other. So you obviously don't want to go through when it's raging. But you just time it with, I think it's like around 45 minutes to 60 minutes after high water slack in Juneau.
Yeah.
You just sit outside and wait for it to go slack. You can see the rapids. And then you just kind of have 15 minutes window of where you can get through. And it's about 20 feet when it's at high water depth. And we actually, kind of a little bit of a tangent, but we took our drone up. Anytime it wasn't raining, which is not very often, we just have a Mavic drone. And we would take that thing up and park it, you know, 500 feet above whatever channel we're trying to go through. Because when you're up there with the drone, you can just put your iPad on your chart table and be able to see your boat and where the shoals are relative to your boat. So it's because we didn't have forward-looking sonar, that was a huge resource for getting in there. We were able to kind of scout it out where the shoals were before trying to approach it. But man, yeah, we could talk about it for a long time. Like for me, all the like Tenakee Springs... On the outside of, so the day after we grounded in Didrikson on the west side of Chichagof was White Sulfur Hot Springs. And for me, that was, there's a lot of hot springs up here, but that was the coolest hot spring. It's got I think the Forest Service built a recent, really beautiful structure around the hot springs. And it's right in front of the ocean. You've got like big swell coming in and it's got two huge sliding glass windows that you can open up to be, it's an enclosed hot spring, but you can open up these beautiful glass sliders and look out over the ocean and let the cool breeze come in and cool you off. And it's got a nice, you know, nice concrete tub all the way around the hot springs. And we had it to ourselves for like 3 hours. We just were lounging in there and I could have stayed longer. But that was the highlight for me. And, you know, Warm Springs Bay, there's all these like really cute communities that seem to congregate around hot springs. So like Tenakee Hot Springs, which is, you know, smart. You're in Alaska. Yeah. So, I mean, anyone that's looking to do it, I mean, we could write you a whole article on places to go. Yeah. And we've been thinking about doing just like a quick outline of things for highlights for us so people can kind of look out for those. Because that's what we did. We asked people like who had been up here, you know, what was your highlight? Like Ford's Terror. Someone told us about Ford's Terror, said you have to go there. And we were kind of like, oh, okay. You know, and then we looked into it and did it and we're blown away. So it's really helpful to hear about other people's, you know, top spots. And but there's just so many, it's really hard to, you know, your podcast will be like 3 hours long if we just say you're talking about it. And there's a lot of editing, so it'll be nice. Those are the highlights I think for us.
All right, so it definitely sounds like a place worth going no matter what, because it looks and sounds amazing and so unique with all these hot springs and stuff. You know, they're a little bit different, it's in glaciers and, you know, boogie bits and all this you know, challenges, but also kind of a high reward situation there. But it sounds like it's been an amazing trip up north. And obviously now you're well on your way back south. And are you planning on living aboard the boat now for the winter?
Yeah, our goal is, our house is being rented out right now. We did that to save some money while we were gone. So the tenants will be in the house until December. Then our goal from there is to kind of live in both places at once. We've got obviously a lot of projects we need to do. We broke some things. So for the coldest months of the year, we will be living on the boat and in the house so that we can get those projects taken care of and then fully back aboard in March again.
Yeah. And for folks that, I mean, full disclosure, we don't have live aboard status. Like everyone who wants to live aboard, there's 4 year long wait lists in the Pacific Northwest. The way we do it is our marina lets us stay half of the month, right? Pretty standard, 15 days out of the 30 days. So we're pretty close to the San Juans. We just usually just take off at, or in the, just outside our dock, we can anchor out. It's a pretty good anchorage.
Yeah.
So we just usually take off for, you know, a couple weeks, you know, 1 week on, 1 week off, just to try and be nice to the marina. They generally are, you know, if the weather's not great, they're like, ah, don't worry about it. They're pretty loose about it. But yeah, it's changed a lot. Like in 2014, we lived aboard and we just went up, or 2012.
Yeah.
We just went to the marina and said, hey, we want to live aboard. They're like, yeah, cool. $50 extra a month. No wait list. Like, it just was a different world. But there's so many people who want to do it now. It's kind of a trend. Our long-term plan is we're going to live aboard until we take off from Mexico, which we're shooting for 2024. We're waiting until the youngest gets old enough to hold on to things. And she's kind of at a dangerous age where she's like, she knows.
Very brave.
Yeah, she's fearless. She's learned how to climb up our companionway, but obviously doesn't like realize if you fall, you're probably going to die. So it's kind of a battle. We're waiting until our youngest gets to the age of our oldest, which is perfect because she's safe about the boat. She knows the rules and doesn't test them. So we're hoping our youngest is that way, though she's a little bit more, she's a daredevil.
Yeah, that's a good strategy to wait until everybody's old enough to be able to hold on to something properly.
Yeah.
Well, that all sounds so exciting with your, you know, obviously the trip that you've done, you know, and fun winter on board in the Pacific Northwest, I'm sure, but, you know, Mexico and the horizon. Where can people follow you guys' journey and see what you guys are up to and all that?
Yeah.
We've got a page on Facebook that is Sailing Naiad. But other than that, we're just kind of, that's where we just memorialize all of our photos from the trip. But
yeah, we've got a website that's just got our tracker and AIS, and just so people could see our path. And we'll probably keep that up for a little while. But we just kind of have a small online presence. Our boat name is Naiad, NYAD. It's kind of a weird spelling. So you can check us out there. We're going to try and upload. We have like way more photos than we've actually uploaded. So we've got a little bit of digging to do. We're going to try and post some more and recommendations, but people are also welcome to just reach out to us. We'd be happy to give people advice, or if you're up in Blaine, you want to go out on the boat, let me know. And for folks that are looking to do this trip, I mean, I would definitely encourage, if you're on Facebook, definitely join some of the Inside Passage groups.
Yeah.
The Inside Passage to Alaska, or Boating the Inside Passage to Alaska, yeah. I think is the official name, is a great group. And that was a huge resource for us. That's where we did our Zoom calls. And we actually created like a boat list of all the boats going up, made a PDF with MMSIs and like what your skills are. So if someone broke down, like you could ask for help and all that. And then there's Alaska Sailors. That's a good one too. A lot of good information on there. So yeah, check those out if you are planning on doing it.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you for sharing those tips and thank you for sharing your story and your experiences. This has been wonderful.
Yeah, it's nice meeting you.
Thanks for having us.
We're a big fan of the podcast. It's been helpful for us. I mean, you heard our story of like cyclical back to the boat and then off. And it's, I think last year we listened to it like in the midst of our boat projects, and it kept us motivated. I was like rebuilding our keel in our garage, and it was like tons of dusty fiberglass and epoxy, and I was just itchy every day. And I was like listening to the light at the end of the tunnel. It was a good reminder for even us. So thank you much.
There you have it. Thanks again to Mark and Sharon for chatting with me. Go check out their amazing photos from their trip. I've linked their Facebook page in the description. As usual, thank you for listening. I appreciate you tuning in every week. At the beginning of last episode, I mentioned Outer Passage and that I did a trip with them in Maine. If you haven't checked out their website yet, go have a look, and if there's an adventure that interests you, just remember that you can get 10% off by mentioning that you listen to the podcast. Darren and Amanda were my very first podcast guests ever, so their interview is season 1, episode 1, and I did another one with them a year later. I would love to help their sailing business grow, so I encourage you to go check them out. As usual, next week it's time for another sailing adventure, so stay tuned. Bye for now.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.